Doubt, debauchery, and dullness. I'm Lance Leffler, and this is what we're going to get into in today's episode of God Meets the Grind. If it was ever true that you can't go home, this story is where they got that idea. In Mark chapter 6, Jesus goes home to Nazareth, where he grew up, where his family still lives. He goes into the synagogue on the Sabbath and teaches, the same powerful authoritative teaching we've seen earlier in the book. And what's the hometown response? Well, they say two really opposite things. They acknowledge his wisdom and mighty works, and then they remember it's just Jesus from the block. And they get offended at him. If I were Jesus, I'd be like, did I mention I just raised a girl from the dead? Do you not watch the news? David Garland, in his commentary on Mark, says this about his family's doubts. I think he really nails it. He says, they're not driven so much by a desire to know what is behind Jesus' miracles as by an itch to confirm their private prejudice that he can't be all that remarkable. This is a good warning for us today. Are we open to the gospel, or are we just out to prove that Jesus isn't who he claimed to be? But here's the crazy thing about the life of Jesus. He was perfect. He was always perfect. He never sinned. And yet his family doubted. It's mind-blowing. I got thinking about this, how Jesus grew up perfect. It's so hard to even imagine what that looked like, but he did it. But don't you think that somehow he had to try to come off not looking like he was perfect? You know how ruthless kids are. If the teacher likes you because you're well-behaved and you do all your homework, the other students are going to roast you. And think about it. Jesus never blew up mailboxes with M80s, never needed a spanking or a timeout if his parents were more, you know, modern. Mary must have constantly scolded his brothers, saying stuff like, why can't you be more like Jesus? Or telling them, man, I'm just making this up on the spot. What would Jesus do? Whatever it looked like, they had to have seen something different in Jesus, right? It makes me think that when he began his ministry, they would have put two and two together. But they didn't. And Jesus marveled at their unbelief. This story illuminates the realism of the New Testament, I think. If the disciples were making it up, they wouldn't have included a story about how his family didn't believe in him. And you thought it was bad when your mom turned your old bedroom into her craft room. Flash to the next scene. Jesus is sending out the 12 disciples to teach and heal. The contrast with the family story is dramatic. Jesus is now taking his ministry to the next level. This is the first time they're called apostles in Mark. It's funny when you read about the apostles in the Gospels with all their blunders and missteps. Again, if they were making the story up, I don't think they would have portrayed themselves so badly. That's why it's kind of funny for me when I see certain Christians online pretending to be apostles these days. Mark cuts away from the apostles and takes us into the halls of the ruler, Herod Antipas, now, where we find that Herod has heard all about the things Jesus is doing, and he's really agitated because he thinks John the Baptist has risen from the dead. Remember John the Baptist? You might not. That's because he shows up in the first chapter and then disappears from the narrative. John, who came to prepare the hearts of the people for the message of Jesus, got into trouble with King Herod. Herod, who wasn't really a king, was a local magistrate in Galilee, a client king of the Roman Empire. It was a made-up office that his grandfather had snagged by currying favor with Julius Caesar 80 years earlier. Herod liked to listen to John the Baptist. He also liked his brother's wife, Herodias. That odd combination reminds me of that line from the Nirvana song, In Bloom. He likes all our pretty songs, and he likes to sing along, and he likes to shoot his gun. I had a short-lived blog a while back, and in my bio I said that I like long walks on the beach with my pit bull and songs that make me cry. But it was all true, except she's a pit bull mix, according to my kids. Anyway, Herod liked Herodias, and Herodias liked Herod. Did I mention that she was also his niece? So she divorced Herod's brother, and they hooked up. And what's with the similar names? It's like when Taylor Swift dated Taylor Lautner. I'm Herod. I'm Herodias. Sorry, I got distracted. But when it came to John the Baptist, he was fearless and told Herod that this was wrong. No, not the name thing, but marrying your sister-in-law niece. For some reason, Herod needed this pointed out to him. So Herodias wanted John killed, but Herod feared him, and feared an uprising if he put John to death. Herod was a punk, so he had John put in prison. Then one day Herod threw this massive stag party with all his nobles and military commanders and leading men of Galilee. And Herodias' daughter came in and danced some presumably sketchy erotic dance in front of all these men. And Herod was so taken with her that he made this reckless vow that he would give her whatever she wanted, up to half his kingdom. Not that he was a king. She goes to her mom, who's not at the banquet, note that, and says, "What should I ask for?" And her mom says, "The head of John the Baptist on a platter." She didn't even have to think. Herod has really blown it now. If he refuses her, he'll be humiliated before his leaders. But he can't have John killed. He likes him. But Herod's a punk, so he chooses his reputation over doing the right thing. He orders John beheaded. So this brings us back to the beginning of this story, where Herod was hearing all about what Jesus was doing. For some reason, he didn't know much about Jesus, and he fears that John has risen from the dead. And can you imagine? If death can't stop John, then who's to say he's not going to come looking for revenge? Maybe he could scale the palace walls or fly in Herod's window and strangle him. And would he be still, you know, headless? Gulp. I bet Herod didn't sleep for weeks. Oh, I forgot to tell you, we're in the middle of another Markan sandwich. In verse 30, the apostles return from their mission. Jesus is eager to get alone with them and hear how it went. So they get into a boat and cross the lake, hoping to get away from the crowds. But the crowds follow them. And instead of reacting the way Lance would, Jesus has compassion on them and begins teaching them and spends the day with them until it's late. So the disciples tell Jesus to send the people away so they can get something to eat. But Jesus says, "You give them something to eat." This leads into the famous feeding of the 5,000. The disciples have 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. So Jesus organizes the first ever church picnic for 5,000. He orders people to sit in groups, blesses the food, and the disciples hand it out. There's a subtle theological picture being painted here by Mark that you might not notice at first, unless you're familiar with the story of the Exodus of Israel from Egypt in the Old Testament. Remember Prince of Egypt? I knew you knew your Bibles. Over a period of 40 years, Israel wandered in the Sinai Desert. Long story, we'll get to that in another series. But God miraculously provided bread for them, called manna, to sustain them. So here, in this desolate place, Jesus is miraculously providing bread to sustain the crowds. When everyone has eaten their fill, they take up all the scraps, and they find they have more food left over than they started with. I've never seen that at a church potluck. But there was something about this miracle that the disciples were supposed to pick up on. But they didn't. This leads into the next scene. After the meal, Jesus dismisses the crowds and he sends his disciples back across the lake in the boat while he goes up on the mountain to pray. Day turns to night, and Jesus sees, supernaturally, that the disciples are struggling, rowing against the wind to make it across the lake. So it says about the fourth watch of the night, that's 3 a.m. to 6 a.m., they look up and see Jesus coming towards them. But he's not in a boat. He's walking on the water. This is another living parable. Only God can tread the waves. The book of Job in the Old Testament says in chapter 9, verse 8, that God stretched out the heavens and trampled the waves of the sea. But the disciples aren't thinking about sublime divine literary parallels right now. They just think Jesus is a ghost, and they're terrified. But probably not as terrified as Herod is in his bed right now. But then Jesus tells them it's him, and not to be afraid. And he gets into the boat, and the wind ceases. And Mark says they're astounded. Listen to this. Because they did not understand about the loaves. What? Okay, real quick. I think they were supposed to see that he was the same God who miraculously provided bread for their forebears in the desert. But the parallel was too subtle for them to catch. We're just the same a lot of the time. If I didn't have good Bible study resources, I don't know how long it would have taken for me to catch that. So Jesus turned the disciples inside out with his appearance in the waves in the middle of the night. When they signed up with Jesus, they had no idea what they were getting into. I wonder if Jesus wants to do the same with us, to ruin us for ordinary life, to become our obsession, our most confounding, mind-bending, unnerving, disorienting, glorious uprooting of everything we thought was true focus. And you thought we were just going to look at a nice book from the Bible today. Thanks for listening. If you liked today's episode, please share it with somebody. Also, if you're on Facebook, would you go on and follow our God Meets the Grind Facebook page? Thanks so much. For more encouragement or to get in touch with me or to support the podcast, go to godmeetsthegrind.com.